providing English classes right now. We're not providing football or soccer recreation services. And as you note, there is quite an irony in saying that there isn't funding available for something really basic, like, you know, how much does a soccer ball cost?
We're going to have to leave it there. Immigration reporter with Reveal. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8 o'clock. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Jim James of My Morning Jacket and the Claypool-Lennon Delirium, featuring Les Claypool and Sean Lennon, Thursday, June 27th. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information available online at zooconcerts.com. And now stay tuned for Wednesday Talk Radio with host Jacqueline Keeler. She'll talk about her experience as a native journalist, and she'll take your calls.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Patrick Kimmons Birthday Remembrance on Monday, June 17th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Southwest 4th Avenue and Harvey Milk Street in Portland. Patrick Kimmons was born on June 17th, 1991. This will be his birthday remembrance and protest of his murder by Portland police on September 30th, 2018. This event will have food, water, soda, coffee, candles, and opportunities to share memories of Patrick and organize against police violence. Again, that's Patrick Kimmons' birthday remembrance on Monday, June 17th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Southwest 4th Avenue and Harvey Milk Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Road to the Green New Deal Town Hall on Sunday, June 16th at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Sunrise Movement PDX hosts the Portland leg of the National Road to the Green New Deal Tour, featuring local activists like Antonio Zamora of For the People, community leaders, and key political players Representative Blumenauer and Senator Merkley. All will discuss the plan for tackling the climate crisis and creating jobs in the process. Again, that's the Road to the Green New Deal Town Hall on Sunday, June 16th at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
a dream between the click of the light and the start of the dream. Between the click of the light and the start of the dream. Between the click of the light and the start of the dream.
Radio on KBOO, and this is Jacqueline Keeler. I don't know if I was live earlier when I was talking, and yeah, I'm here hosting it without Paul Roland today. He's on travel right now, and I thought that I would open up a discussion today about my experiences as a native journalist covering the most powerful country on earth that is presently occupying my own homelands, and maybe answer some questions about what that means. I know that there are a number of questions that come up all the time about being native and what that is that I have to address over and over again in my coverage of Indian country and of the United States. And I think the big issue is often the differences between the perspective of a native person and the perspective that is often carried in mainstream media concerning what the United States is and what it does. I think one of the main issues that come up often is well, I mean, it's pretty basic, which is who and what is an Indian? And I think that on my links here, I include a link to my my latest articles. You can go to muckrack.com. You can go to the website here at KBOO's Wednesday Talk Radio, and you can find a link today's show to my portfolio of articles. And you'll notice that a lot of them have to do with that issue, whether you're talking about Warren, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, and her claims to distant Native ancestry, and untraceable Native ancestry, I should include, and also the issue of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which I've been writing about, and the issue of pretendianism of fake tribes and how that impacts actual Native nations. And you might want to ask yourself, why do so many people pretend to be Indian, right? And why is that a problem? But when you have to ask yourself, who is an Indian, every time you have to address a story about Native people, you can see how that really clouds the issue, clouds the how things matter to Native nations. You don't ask yourself that question about any the national interests of any other nation, you know, whether someone is French, whether someone is German or not. And I think, and this really has to do with the history of this country, which is predicated on the erasure of Native nations. So I think that one of the things that I've been really looking at lately is the issue of the United States being a colony. In function, if not overt stated form, in the sense that it is a colony that that never stopped being a colony when it broke off from, it fought a Revolutionary War to divide itself politically from its homeland, but that doesn't make these lands the homelands of the United States. These are territories that they're actively occupying. And I think this was very visible at Standing Rock, that this is a military occupation. And I think I brought that up that many times here on this show. And that the military response by the state of North Dakota, which is occupying, the United States government has flouted international law by occupying a great deal of North Dakota and South Dakota. There are active treaties with Native nations, particularly with the Great Sioux Nation, and a great deal of the land west of the Missouri River should be returned to the Great Sioux Nation, including the land where Standing Rock took place. So that's all within the Fort Laramie Treaty. And it's called unceded treaty land, and basically it's held militarily and unoccupied by the U.S. government. And that land also includes Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills. So if that land was returned, people often say, "What could I do for Indian people? I feel sad about them. I feel bad about what they're going through." Well, it's really quite simple. You can insist that the U.S. government honor the treaties, return the land that it's occupying illegally, and then I think that we would be doing a lot better. I mean, that area just covered under the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851, and that area, it's the size of Great Britain. You know, I mean, we would have a country which we could actually begin to do certain things and to support our people. These are things that right now the financial benefits of which go to state governments like North Dakota and South Dakota and Wyoming and Montana. And so if these lands are returned, then those incomes and everything would then go to Native people directly. The states exist in basically defiance of the political existence of Native nations. It erodes their political existence, their political reality. And it's the erosion of our political reality and our claims to land, which is why it is so difficult to know who is Native and who is not, because that's the whole purpose of that policy, is to make that difficult to determine, so in order to cloud our claims to the land. And this is why when white people pretend to be Indian, you know, because it makes them feel good, or because they are actually acting under an act of delusion. This is why this is such a difficult problem. And so I think it's not a harmless thing. Or there have been told family stories, and they don't really know where those family stories came from, whether it was, a romantic notion, or whether it was actually a bit more serious than that, where their ancestors tried to lay claim to Indian lands falsely and filed a story. This often happened with the Cherokee Nation. In fact, where white people, white families, they knew they were white, but they filed false claims in order to get Indian land. And if you read, what happened in with the Osage, and there's a book out, something of the Prairie Moon. They white men began marrying Native women to basically get their lands, and they would murder them for their oil rights, their head rights, and this was actually the start of the FBI actually to investigate these string of murders that were going on in Oklahoma. And so claims to being Indian, it's not necessarily, they weren't, people weren't doing it, white people were not doing it necessarily because they liked Indians. There was a desire for the land, there was a greed for the land, and this greed really goes back to the very origins of the United States. And this is actually something I've been examining a lot. I'm working on a book called Standoff, which compares the Bundy takeover here in Oregon and Malheur, which I covered in January and February of 2016, to Standing Rock, which I also covered in 2016. And I started the year in January covering the takeover at Malheur with a bunch of white men with guns and snow, and I ended it in December of 2016 at Standing Rock in North Dakota in the snow amongst my own people who had guns pointed at them from more white men. But I think that if you look at the origins of this country, it really came back to the desire for colonists, English colonists, to gain more land. One of the main issues with King George III was that he had, with the end of the French and Indian War, he had issued this proclamation of 1763, which said that that there was a line, basically the Appalachian Mountains, that the colonists could not cross. They could not go west of that. That land was protected for Indian people, and so they and this upset the colonists because they wanted access to that land west of the Appalachians. They wanted Indian land, and this is what they went to war for. This is what the Revolutionary War was really about. The reason why the British government was taxing them was to pay for the war debt from what we call the French and Indian War here in the United States, but which is called in Europe, is called the Seven Years' War. And that was really the first world war. It was all continents, all the different areas. Some historians call it World War Zero. And it was actually started, that war was actually started in Western Pennsylvania. And it actually started by a young Virginia officer named George Washington. He was with a party. He was trying to, the state of Virginia, the colony of Virginia had claims to that area, to the Ohio Valley. And because of the way their charter was written by the crown. And so they were sending, they sent George Washington up there with a group, with a bunch of soldiers to assert Virginia's right, and to, because the French were building forts up and down there to try to assert the French domination of the area. And he got into a battle, and they murdered one of the French diplomats. And this caused international conflagration. Basically, it started World War Zero. And so it was the thirst for land that basically brought about this world war and doubled the national debt of England, of Britain at the time. And in fact, they had so much debt that just paying the interest took up half of the entire budget for the British government, and so it was incredibly expensive. What they were doing on the frontier, what the colonists were doing on the frontier, had an incredible expense to it, and this was what they were being asked to pay for with these different taxes, the Stamp Act and all the intolerable acts. And they didn't. They were used to being able to get away with doing a lot of smuggling. And they, for their rum and everything, they just didn't want to have to actually pay for the war that they had started. And so the U.S. has really benefited from being able to pawn off the expenses of this on other peoples, whether you're talking about their home country, whether you're talking about my people, and the taking of the Black Hills and all the gold that was in there. I understand the U.S. government was actually bankrupt at the time after the Civil War, and the gold they took out of the Black Hills helped restore the profitability of the country, the U.S. government. And so there's always been the frontier, the ability to push westward, the ability to take more land. And this is really the impetus for this country. So I think that the erasure of Native people, the erasure of our political rights to the land, the blurring of the lines of who we are, it is all part of that whole process and has been ongoing for a very long time. So that's when I cover those stories about these issues, and they keep coming up. And it's sort of annoying because to me, it's obvious who Native people are, and some of the different areas where it can be difficult to decide are definitely due to U.S. policy. When you look at the Indian Child Welfare Act, which I've been writing about, you have this issue where the U.S. government started as a policy, to start taking Native children from Native families. And this is an act that is actually covered under the Geneva Conventions on Genocide. And these conventions basically find that the removal of children from an ethnic minority is a form of is a form of genocide. And at the rate it was being done, in the 1970s, a congressional report found that it was up to about 25 to 35% of all Native children were being taken from their families and placed in white families. And this could be for all kinds of spurious reasons, from that they were part of a multi-generational family living situation, or they had an outhouse instead of a flush toilet, things like that. When you look at the lack of expenditure in any country for infrastructure, it's pretty ridiculous to make that an issue. They were removing children at an incredible rate. And you have to think about, what if 35% of all American children were being taken and raised in another country, right? What would that say? Or, that happened to any other country, whether you're talking about, Belgium or Sweden, where 35% of their children were being removed for no really good reason and being sent to another country to be raised. And this is the issue that faces Indian country. And so it's very frustrating when a lot of coverage, the New York Times had a piece recently about the Indian Child Welfare Act and this Texas couple who are trying to, they're taking it to the Supreme Court with their right to adopt a part Navajo child. And they're claiming, the tribes are, this isn't in the best interest of the children. And for some reason, when they're placing these children in foster care, they're still placing them with white families. And it just seems, there was a lot of studies done in South Dakota where they found that even though there were many Native foster families, they weren't getting any placements. The placements were all being filtered to white families. And so the system is still in place to remove Native children and to take them away from the influences of their own people. And I can attest, when I write, I can definitely attest to the importance of having the perspective that my parents gave me, right? I have two Native parents. They come from different tribes, from different perspectives. My mother's a full-blood Navajo. She grew up speaking her language. Her parents, my grandparents, were traditional Navajos. They didn't speak English. They had a ranch, my grandfather was a cowboy, and my grandmother wove rugs. They also raised sheep as well as cattle. And this was their life. They lived a traditional Navajo life till they died in the 21st century. And we're very lucky to have had that continuation of culture. Many tribes have not. And then my father's family were more acculturated. They have been going to college for over 100 years, probably since the 1880s. And so, they were educated for a long time, and yet they still retained hope that they'd be able to return to their own traditions. And that happened in the 1970s when the laws against, our religion was outlawed. And so by the U.S. government, and it wasn't until the 1970s that it was legal again to practice our religion, the sun dance and all the things that were meaningful to the Dakota and Lakota people. And so at that point, I think most of our tribe went back to our traditions because we were forced to take up a lot of the Christianity and stuff under treaty with the U.S. government. So it's those experiences, those family experiences, and that perspective that provides, and that is taught to you in your family by your parents, by your grandparents, by your extended family, and knowing those stories and knowing their perspective is so important to me. And if I had been removed from my family, if I'd been one of those 35% of kids who were removed, I would not have any of that, and I would be in a much more vulnerable place as far as being able to address these issues, and to formulate a response. I think you can't formulate responses entirely in a vacuum, or being raised by white people, even well-meaning white people who don't know anything about the experiences that we've gone through in our families. I think growing up, I got so much, a lot of encouragement from the stories told in my family about how different members of my family responded to racism, to oppression, and when I'm going out and I'm interviewing Native people about the things that are happening in their communities, I'm attentive to those stories. I listen for that, and it shows in my writing. I think we often, some of the reporting that comes out from, particularly white reporters who parachute into Native communities is very, it's very one note, it's very much poor Indians, poverty porn. And, every 10, 20 years, some white journalist finds out there's a reservation again, or shows up at Pine Ridge again and does a story, and it's the same story. And I think that what Native journalists bring is we bring a different eye to it, and we already know that we have a much broader base to draw upon to frame the story, to understand it, and in the end humanize Native people for other Americans and other readers. So I'd like to encourage you to call in. I'm trying to think what the 503-231-8187, and I'd be love to talk to you and hear your questions about what you think of Native journalism, questions you have about, who and what is a Native person. I think one of the things that I wanted to maybe read from is I'm working on my book about the Bundy takeovers, and I know that recently last week the Hammonds their grazing, they had been reissued their grazing permits by the BLM by Trump's administration. The Hammonds, of course, were the family who the father and the son, ranchers in Harney County in southeastern Oregon, who had to go to prison for arson. They had been conducting hostilities and an arranged war with the Fish and Wildlife Service and other federal agency representatives for since the 1990s, really. And they had a lot of the other ranchers in around Malheur, the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, had already have been working for several years, maybe about I think 5 to 7 years, on creating a compact, a management, a conservation compact with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and which was signed in 2013, and they and it's been. It's been a great, they had a lot of input into, ranchers had a lot of input into it, the Audubon Society, all kinds of stakeholders, including the Burns Paiute Tribe, and they were able to create a sort of management plan for the wildlife refuge that they all agreed on. And but the Hammonds would not take part in it, and so they continued being incredibly hostile to federal workers. And they actually were found guilty of basically arson, and this included starting fires that endangered the lives of firefighters and of okay, we have a caller. But basically, the judge had decided to revoke the permits for the Hammonds, so they could not continue grazing. Hello, LJ, you're on. Kabu.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
Good.
All right, so I've got a story to tell.
Uh-huh.
Several years ago, I took a creative writing workshop, and one of the people in the workshop was what is referred to as a Rosebud Sioux.
Oh yes, yeah.
Okay, she was raised on the res. Okay, every fall she was taken from her tribe, and sent to a boarding school.
Uh-huh.
Run by nuns. All right. And she wanted to write a book for her grandchildren to show what kind of abuse that she had to put up with at
wow.
the hands of the nuns. And Jack, some of the stories that she would tell would send chills up your spine.
Wow.
If they would speak their native language, the nuns would tie a rubber band around their tongue and snap it.
Oh, my God.
Plus other abuses of a sexual nature that I will simply leave up to your imagination.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's...
And then every fall, and then every spring, she was returned to her tribe.
Jeez.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm sure that as far as the nuns were concerned, they were simply trying to tame the savages. So tell me, Jack, who's the savage?
I know.
Yeah. And just one more, and just one more quick point. Has the United States ever lived up to any treaty that it has ever signed with any native person? And take care, have a good day, and thank you for what you do.
Thank you, LJ. So, yeah, I think, I don't know if there was a question. The question was, who's the savage? And I would definitely think, the hatred and the rage and the anger that was brought to our people, to our vulnerable children in these boarding schools is just... It has such a terrible legacy in our families, on our reservations, of pain, of suffering, and it's right now there is a lawsuit going on in South Dakota for this group called Nine Little Girls, and they're trying to get some justice for children who were actually sold by these churches for like $10 to anybody who wanted them, and that the whole adoption history that was back in the 1950s and 60s is just horrific, because of course who's going to adopt these children? There's no vetting done, and often with these folks who were sent out to the reservation from these priests and such, nuns, and they were people who had already been removed from other dioceses because of complaints. And so we ended up with them, and of course the issues of child sexual molestation is endemic throughout these institutions, not just in Indian country, but that was one of these people can do a lot of damage. I know that there was a priest in Alaska who basically, you know, molested most of the children of an entire generation flying around by his airplane all over Alaska. And I remember reading one on the Hopi Nation where, a teacher, he molested like 70, 80 kids. And that's like in a tribe that small, that has a huge impact, you know? And, these are really painful parts of our history. So is there Suzanne still online?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi. I appreciate what you're saying, and I want to make atonement myself. My mother's great-great cousin was General George Custer, and I would be very willing. I live in Salem, but I have a retirement income, not a lot, but I'm willing to join and construct some sort of gather up group that can tell the real stories with each other, because that's the only way. I'm a psychotherapist, and I've heard too many stories by all kinds of people, gay, straight, men, women, whatever tribe, that these stories of true anger, of helplessness, of feeling like an animal being cornered, we will heal, help, walk with each other so that we can begin to heal.
I think, you know,
what would you suggest?
Well, yeah, I think the big issue right now here is missing and murdered indigenous women.
Yeah,
and that's been they've been trying to address that issue, and I've been covering it as a journalist and hearing the stories of families and what they're going through and trying to find their loved ones, and that's definitely a point of healing right now. You could definitely contribute and help with that process. I think it's there's actually a group here.
I would be very happy to, and I also know that the pain is minor compared with the deep wound that never leaves an abused person. That's down to the soul.
And it's also intergenerational too. I mean, that pain is passed down, you know.
Oh yes, yes, yes. And of course, as a female, I find that women are very able, with support, to ask for what they need. Not take it. Not, go to the corner and, shut up or whatever. But I live here in Salem right now, but I'm willing to, ride the bus up and help others, find some kind of bona fide support group that's safe, and that we don't need to use our names if we don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, one of the reasons I'm writing the book Standoff is to examine, the book will actually be coming out, during the 2020 elections, and I'm not sure where Trump is going to be at that point, whether he's going to, if he's going to be in jail or prison.
He's never going.
Yeah, I think I suspect that
healthy.
He will probably be winning, and I think that's going to be, so my book will be coming out at that point, and I want to address the trauma of that situation. And I think it would be a very traumatic situation for a lot of Americans. And
these things, listening is not hearing.
Yeah, yeah.
If you hear, you act.
So I think that, I think it's, I'm just trying to address your question is, is that that it's you know, I think trying to understand where each group is coming from, you know, in the let me look if I can get this computer here. I actually where is the window here? Sorry, just a second. Here. I opened the book saying the introduction to my book is called Why the Stories in the Land Matter. The lens we see the world and our America through defines not only our personal understanding of history, but it does so often to the exclusion of the experiences of other peoples that history has also touched. It is this exclusivity of viewpoint that is illustrated and explored by examining and comparing the two standoffs in this book. What I've tried to provide is a framing to understand both how the Standing Rock Sioux tribe understands its history and asserts its rights as a nation, as an Oyate, and to contrast this with the Bundy family and their armed supporters faced off against their own federal government, even as they venerate the U.S. Constitution, which they keep in their shirt pockets. So it's a very complicated situation, but so that's why I wrote a whole book about it, comparing like where we're coming from in these different perspectives.
I'm a bit of a writer too, and it gets me coming and going.
Yeah.
But
I
always say when I'm ready to write a poem, I act like I'm pregnant and I go outdoors. You know, I don't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
Except the birds. And I don't answer my phone.
Yeah, that's been my situation the past.
That works. I've not given away whatever. Oh yeah.
Okay, we have two more callers. Thank you, Suzanne. So
all right. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. So hello, Joe. Joe?
No, this is Lee.
Oh, this is Lee. Hi, Lee. How are you?
I'm doing good. I guess I have a. And I really want to thank you for the information that you're providing. We need this perspective. The New York Times just and you know, mass media just does not provide the information that we need to be informed. But I want to take a different perspective and say I really hope that we can learn, and I mean, you know, the majority of the population, can learn the wisdom that tribal peoples still retain with regard to their interactions with the earth. And it seems to me that this can be a more positive, life-affirming approach to interactions between individuals and peoples.
Yeah, I think you know, in my book, I compare, you know, the Bundy's sovereign citizen idea to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and the Great Sioux Nations, the Ocheti Shekoan's notion of itself as a people, right? And I compare them as algorithms, actually, and I see that you know, with the colonial people. You know, and I use the term colonist, not settler colonialism. I think that I just use the term straight up colonist. I think that that with the colonist, you know, it's obvious the algorithm. You know, it's you know occupy other people's lands, extract the wealth as quickly as possible. You know, send that money back to your ruling class, to the 1%, and this is the, you know, this is the algorithm of a colony, right? And we see what the outcomes are for that, and you know, it's but for Native people, and I use a definition of people, and most Native people call themselves a people. You know, Diné in Navajo means the people. We call ourselves Diné, and then it's a people, and I'm using a definition that I got from my grandma's cousin Vine Deloria Jr. And he talks about how a people are they have an origin story that's based in a meeting with a manifestation of the land itself, with a spiritual being who is a manifestation of the land itself. And in that meeting, we're given our original instructions. We're given the rules in which we are to live on that land. And that land is a specific place. It's not the entire world, you know. And so we are accountable to that place and to the people who are already there. You know, for my father's people, that would be the Buffalo Nation, and the spiritual manifestation that we met was the white buffalo calf woman. She was a manifestation of the Great Plains and of which we were becoming a people of, right? And at that point, my Lala used to say, you know, when we met the white buffalo, before we met the white buffalo calf woman, we were not Dakota. After we met her, we were, you know, we were Dakota. Before that, we were something else. And so at that point, we met her and we agreed to these rules of how we were going to live on the land and what our obligations were going to be to all the other people who were already there, the Buffalo Nation, you know, everyone who was already there. You know, at that point, then we became Dakota, we became a people. And it's the rules that we were given that creates the algorithm, the rules of responsibility, of mutual respect, that create an algorithm that present completely different outcomes than that of colonialism. And so that's the way in which, you know, so when I look at the book is I really examine these two stories, these origin stories, very closely. In fact, I did a lot of research, particularly. I was already really familiar with my father's people. I did my thesis in college on it, but I really had to do a lot of research on the Bundys and the English history that their family history represents, and so it's very interesting. And I don't know if it's possible to marry the two. And when I give a lecture about how the U.S. is still a colony, I look at the audience and I say, so you know, this means, you know, you're a colonist. You know, you might be a good person, and you consider yourself a good person, a moral person, but you are a colonist. So what would ethical colonialism look like? And really, that is the question that we're facing today.
Exactly. How do people, you know, if given a choice between the Bundy algorithm and, you know, the Dene or Lakota algorithm, how do the people who are living where they are learn to make a choice?
To
learn how to live with that wisdom of the place.
Exactly. And with an agreement to it. And you know, with corporations, they can move on. You know, they can go and despoil a place and then move on to somewhere else. They're not tied to a specific place on earth, you know.
Right.
And so like the Dene Ta, our sacred lands between the four sacred mountains and the four sacred rivers, you know, that's a specific place on earth. You know, and we have responsibility to that place, and we have any of the outcomes that happen there, we have to, you know, we have to live with them. And
well, the key word there is responsibility.
Yeah.
And how do individuals learn what those responsibilities are?
Exactly. Well, thank you, Lee. I think Joe's still waiting on the phone.
Okay. Well, keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Joe, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for your writing and all you do for Indian country, first of all.
Thanks.
Also, my question kind of piggybacks on the last two callers in terms of resource extraction and group action in this modern age of technology and social media. So my question is, social media seems to have connected us in great new ways, and it's come at a time after the 1998 and 2008 recessions, when all of the Americas, Latin America and North America, are at very great risk of resource extraction, because that's how they're going to get themselves out of the recession, right?
Yeah.
And so indigenous people from Latin America and North America are talking, but there really doesn't seem to be much movement. I mean, we have NCAI that seems to not do a whole lot, and then I do admire there in the Northwest, the affiliated tribes of Northwest Indians, they seem to do a lot of things and keep their people informed and kind of make some strategic decisions, and also in Arizona there's an intertribal council, but for like, and then in the Great Plains and other places, there doesn't seem to be much organizational capacity. And I'm sure you know of the FBI's efforts to kind of disorganize the Red Power movement and AIM and Black Panthers and all that kind of stuff. So what do you see as a journalist as good organizational structure, and what do you see as a threat to those organizations?
Yeah, I think that you know, my dad's family were very involved with starting NCAI, the National Congress of American Indians, back in the 50s and 60s, and served as executive directors of it. but we haven't been so involved recently. And I do see problems with any sort of organization that is a nonprofit. You know, they're reliant on a lot of grants and certain certain voices get more play because they provide more money, and that skews perspective. I think with the Great Plains, I know that there are different organizations. I know the Great Plains Chairman's Association or something like that. But yeah, I don't know why there isn't more organization. There's probably, some of the tribes do have money now, but most of them don't, I would say. You know, you have a few like Shakopee and with the casino money and of course, you know, the Fort Berthold, you know, MHA, and they have, of course, all the mineral, the fracking money from fracking oil on their reservation. And but yeah, I think it's my big idea for organizing is this crazy idea I've been talking a lot about, which is an idea of a federal indigenous government. And and this goes back to the idea that what the U.S. government's policy has been and colonial policy has been for hundreds of years has been the disappearance of the political reality of Native people, because that's where the real threat is. Is our political reality, our claim to the land, and you can trace that back to the very beginning, and even to the Doctrine of Discovery and the Papal Bulls and from the 15th century, I started thinking about a federal indigenous government was because we need a way in which to be visible, and if we were to have to unify under create a united tribal political entity, we would have a lot more standing, and we would be able to address things on a much it would be harder to ignore us, and so I think it would also we would be an archipelago, which would mean, because of course all the reservation lands are scattered, but if we could formalize as a group, we work together, we could formalize much more. We could get the attention of Americans and get them to really work with their elected officials to recognize the sovereignty, so that these lands are not just lands, federal lands, that the U.S. government holds for us, but that they actually are recognized as our lands again, and in a formal way. And then also we'd be able to create other networks and to be, I think, much more visible. That's sort of my idea. Are you still there, Joe?
Okay. Yeah. So okay. What you like the FBI and the 70s when they dismantled the different minority groups? What kind of things would need to be put in place to prevent that effectiveness again?
Yeah. In all political fights, you see through history, it's difficult. The birth of new things is very difficult, and it's actually sort of uncertain. I studied Russian in college, and I was a student of the Russian Revolution. And you can see quite quickly how things can go from idealism to some kind of victory to Stalin. that would be the worst. That'd be pretty horrific sort of case. Or even Gorbachev's ideals leading to Putin. this is terrible progress of events. But I think that unless you try, I think that all we can do is try. And with this particular situation, I would say the carrot, the stick, is actually being presented by the Republicans, which is the threat of termination of tribes. With the ICWA cases, the Indian Child Welfare Act cases, a lot of the funding for these adoptions and in defense of these white adoptive families, couples, is actually coming from the right wing of the Republican Party, and is working in concert with it. And in part, and the whole goal is they're using ICWA as an attack on tribal sovereignty. And so there is a stick there already, which is the threat of being terminated. And certainly that has been on the table with the Trump administration, And we've seen that in a number of decisions recently coming out of the Bureau of Indian Affairs regarding trust into land issues. And so termination of tribes' existence, which was a policy in the 1950s and 60s until 1970, when actually Nixon ended that policy. And so I think that's the stick that we could drive people to come together, because if we're the idea would be with the federal indigenous government, we can immediately address certain issues that are outstanding in Indian country, including making sure everyone has a Bill of Rights, you know, the issues having to do with citizenship and the attacks from disenrollment, and a lot of internal issues like that can be addressed that are being presently being used to delegitimize our governments. And so, oh, okay, so I have another call. Good talking to you, Joe.
Bye-bye.
Hi, Bill. Hello?
Yes.
Hi. You're on KB.
Hi. Yes. I wanted to, listening to this, I'm an African-American male, and I think one of the things that when you talk about being invisible or not being able to rise to as a result of social constraints, mainly when you think about colonialism and what it does to people in general, it keeps them in various states of arrest. And we don't often think about a reservation really being a form of arrest, kind of like these informal states of arrest. And then when you get away from the reservation, your inability to gain a voice or an audience for what it is that you want to do, and you stay under attack by, I guess, the colonial powers, it never goes away. That constant state of arrest is ghettos for African Americans, mm-hmm. or the Jewish people or whomever. So I think that once we realize that the powers that be keep us in a constant state of arrest, and even when we think we are free to move, when you have no voice, that's still a form of suspended arrest, in my opinion. So those are some of the things that have to be really addressed to truly have a voice to grow out of these situations with respect to all people.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's very well put. I think, you know, that's why just speaking about the idea of a federal indigenous government, it makes us much more visible. And also, you know, who we can include in that federation, I would say would be our decision. It wouldn't be limited to tribes who are already federally recognized. I think it would be a way of getting that recognition. Sovereignty, of course, has its own issues. I mean, you see the U.S. government definitely meddles in the sovereignty and viability of other nations, whether you're talking, policies to isolate certain tribes, certain nations. Who else is online now? Oh, hi, Mitch.
Yes. I know you were at the end of the hour, so yeah. I wanted to propose that you do a show on what the results have been politically and culturally in Canada, where they have acknowledged the Nunavut Nation and what that has meant to the language revival, cultural revival, and identity revival of the Nunavut people approaching the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, I would love to. Actually, my dad's cousin, he's Yankton Sioux, but he's lived and worked most of his adult life in Canada, in Lethbridge in Alberta. He was a professor there, and he was actually he worked with the Canadian helped set up the Nunavut government there when they got started, I think, a couple decades ago.
Anything you could do would be appreciated.
Yeah, I would love to.
The American media system is not that interesting.
It's amazing what they're doing up there. It's a huge area. Isn't it that one Nunavut is like the size of Mexico? I mean, it's a huge province. Okay, we got to go. Great talking to you all. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am a Native journalist based here in Portland, Oregon. And you can find me at Jacqueline Keeler on Facebook and at JF Keeler on Twitter. Until next time. Thanks.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a news and public affairs director to manage the evening news and public affairs programming and to train and supervise volunteers. For this full-time position, we're looking for someone with proven experience in news and public affairs production, management and supervisory skills with volunteers with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. People of color and women are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Coming up next on Radio Zine, Suzanne LeGrand interviews Chris Wilson, author of The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to Life of Purpose. At 9:30, the Women's International News Gathering Service travels to the Arizona-Mexico border to take a look into what asylum seekers are fleeing from and what they face on their trip north. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, the Dirtbag takes on raspberries. Hot weather gardening, planting for fall and winter, and the fig evaluation project. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm, on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to